originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Sabre wins the Derby for Todd Fletcher.
Basalt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Pena.
Hello again, everyone. Good afternoon, and once again, welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Pena, Baron of the Backstretch, coming to you once again from our Jimmy John's of Lexington broadcast studios. Want to extend a very special welcome to everyone across HRRN Nation, including all of you who are listening live throughout North America on Sirius 219, XM 201, and all of you tuned in to our free live streaming or even the archived podcast. If you're listening in that fashion, you're doing that at horseracingradio.net. And really happy to have you with me for the next hour, and it promises to be a fun hour and an educational hour, to say the least, because our guest here tonight began his training career back in the late 80s, right around 1988. He saddled 292 winners to date, and that number would certainly be higher had he not spent three decades serving our country in the military in Afghanistan and in Korea. He worked as an intelligence officer at the Pentagon following 9/11 and eventually retired with the rank of lieutenant colonel. In addition, he obtained his bachelor's degree in animal science at Cornell University, where he also played football, by the way. He has a master's degree from the University of Maryland, and at one point actually ran for Congress. Yeah, that's right. Well, he's now back doing what he loves. He's owning and breeding and training racehorses alongside his wife on their farm in Westminster, Maryland. And he is trainer Larry Smith. Please join me in welcoming Larry to the program here tonight. Larry, appreciate the visit.
Hi, Mike. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Yeah, pleasure to speak with you.
Great meeting you at the Maryland Million last weekend.
Great to meet you there. And by the way, first of all, before we get started, I just want to extend a special, on behalf of myself, certainly, and my wife, Michelle, thank you for what you do for our country. Thanks for serving.
Well, thank you for saying. I've always been blessed with the tools needed to serve as a natural sort of born leader, a natural big guy with a big voice, and somebody. I always say the leadership is sort of the virtuous side of impatience, where you just can't wait any longer for everybody else to do it. You want to get it done in a way that you see. And so it was an amazing 30 years, 4 months that I spent with the U.S. Army and in both reserve and active, and the experiences I had at the Pentagon and the National Military Command Center and in the Maryland National Guard, almost a year in Korea, 6.5 months in Afghanistan. They're just precious memories, and I think a fair trade, a fair exchange, as Humphrey Finney wrote in his book, Fair Exchange. And the day I retired, I didn't miss retiring, but I was sure glad I had done it. So, and the last thing I would say is that I would run into people who maybe had physical challenges or they were past the age where they could serve, and I felt great that I was serving on their behalf too.
Well, let me tell you something, my friend. You caught a bit of a break because, as you know, you can find just about anything you want on the internet. And I went back and researched Larry Smith at Cornell playing football and found out that you played tight end. You weighed in about 220 in those days, 6'3". Couldn't find any of your stats, though. You caught a break. There are no stats out there, so we'll assume that you had a Hall of Fame career at Cornell.
Oh, no, not at all. I came from a small school called Friends School in Baltimore, where I had a football team of 22 people on it at best. But I just loved that sport. I thought there's football and there's all the other sports. And so I walked on as a freshman and with 90 other guys and struggled through. I mean, I just loved being on the football field, and I was a look team for 3 years, getting the guys ready to play the the top team, the A teams on Saturdays, and they would give us JV games against some of the Division III schools on Monday afternoons. But just to be on the football field and to compete, and then finally my senior year to letter as a third-string tight end. I went from eighth string as a freshman to third string as a senior. So,
wow.
All depends on how you define success.
I think as I went through your resume there at the top of the show, I think maybe the only thing that I didn't mention was that you are also in a band, and that's how you and I met when we were at the Country Life tent at the Maryland Million this past week. And you had a box of harmonicas because you play harmonica. You're also the lead singer in that band. So tell me about that story.
Well, I guess music's always been my natural drug, if you will. I was lucky as an 11-year-old for my 11th birthday. My mother took me to see Elvis Presley at the Capitol Center in Washington, D.C. And later as a kid, I saw Muddy Waters live. And I've just had an amazing relationship with music. I had great seats that a horse owner gave me to see U2 at the Hampton Coliseum, and I'm a big Pearl Jam fan, and I have my instrument with me all the time so I can sing wherever I am, and it's just been a labor of love, and karaoke and a few singing lessons and some good friends that can play guitar. Our first drummer in the band was Nick Matinas, my veterinarian, and another trainer, Scott Posey, was our guitar player, and had a jockey named Kenny McMillan, who was another guitar player, and our percussionist was the valet, the colors man, worked in the jocks room, named Sal Cacciatore. And 26 years later, we're still playing music, and we got the call from Cricket Goodall at the Maryland Million to play during the feature time, and that was really surreal to be singing Sweet Caroline as the horses circled in front of the gate for the classic.
Yeah,
talking to Trevor McCarthy and other people and shouting out to them, and they all knew it was me, and it was just a great, great day.
Yeah, but it's quite a moment. And, you think about that relationship that you develop with those guys that are in the band. You mentioned all the different horse people that are involved. And you're not the first person, Larry, to tell me that you gathered up some folks around the racetrack and started a band. I've heard this story before.
How about that?
How often do you play?
We play about three times a month. We're playing the opening day of the hunt for the Elkridge Harford Hunt next week, and we're doing a Halloween party this Saturday. And so the beauty of playing with people who've been playing music for 25, 30 years is that you can just tell them to learn something, and they'll show up prepared. And we call ourselves Aggressively Eclectic, but it's truly a release. That's the name of the band. It's a release for all of us, and it's the best therapy you could give yourself. And I'm just... I feel so blessed that I can make other people smile, and it's so many times you go to a gig and you're in the middle of Pennsylvania or something, in the middle of the night, you're like, how did I get here? But you're so glad you're there, and it's just a great experience.
What's the biggest venue that you've ever played?
Well, I guess the Maryland State Fair, things like that, where you, but I guess our most fun would be some of these mega horse weddings that we do, like the Bonita Farm, Kevin Boniface's daughter married Sam Hopkins, and when you get 300 people and out at Bonita Farm, and everybody's there to have a great time and to dance, and that's as good as it gets for us. We really love that.
So years ago, before professional athletes were being paid millions and millions of dollars to do their job, the athletes had to go out and get a second job to support themselves. Obviously well noted that was the case. You also have a second job now. I mentioned that you're still owning and breeding and training horses alongside your wife, but you have a second job as the Vice President of Business Development at Belts Logistics Services in Baltimore. Tell me about that. How does that all work? How do you keep it all balanced?
Sure. I met Skip Brown as a horse owner, and we trained horses and competed horses for 12 years. Then I did my decade of active Army service from about 2005 to 2013. And when I retired from the military, they needed somebody to tell the world their story. They're a third-party logistics company that provides warehousing and storage and order fulfillment for people that can't, in their business model, can't own their own warehouse. So it's a really neat service we provide to over 100 different companies that mostly import through the Port of Baltimore. So the containers go from Baltimore to our warehouse, and we de-van them, as we call it, and put them on pallets, and then we get them to where they ultimately need to go. But so what I, it's so great as a being in the horse world with a regular income, so that you're not too worried if a horse loses or if a horse needs to be laid up. I remember when I was a full-time trainer, the uncomfortable feeling of if I don't hit the board in this race, I'm not sure how I'm going to make payroll. And that's, I think every trainer has had that feeling at one time or another, particularly back in the days before there was all these runners rewards that we get now that make the game so much easier. I think Colonial Downs set the standard with $1,000 to every horse that ran. And as the blacksmiths that I ran into down there told me, it's everybody's paying me for some reason. I don't have to chase anybody down for money. And it's just so great when the bare expenses can be paid and that horses and people can stay in the game long enough for their conditions to come around or their distance or their surface to come back around and they can win some money in the front end of the races. So I on my 20-acre farm with my wife Connie, we're doing sort of what I call race and recovery. So I'm getting old-timers like Starry Messenger and Second Encore and Golden Chance and horses that know what they're doing, and we just race them and turn them out and gallop them in our backfield, which is a third of a mile. We have a great rider that lives right next door to us, and so we get that done, and then we race them again. And for the real training, to break a horse and get him to the gate and everything, I sent him to Chucky Lawrence at Fair Hill, who's a lifelong friend of mine. And back when I was a full-time trainer, he and I would get our papers crisscross his horse ID because they'd see the Lawrence and they'd think I was him and he was me. And because I was Lawrence M. Smith, that's how I race. So it's a nice partnership, and the larger your network, the better you do. You know, the more people you have to dial up to help you do things, the better you do. And that's definitely a lesson I've learned. It goes way back to when I was a National Guardsman and I had to be away one weekend a month. So I had to learn who could do this for me while I'm gone. And I've kept that with me, and it's amazing what you can do when you get some help.
Yeah, talking with trainer Larry Smith, Lawrence M. Smith, in your program, as you just heard him say, here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fezzik Tipton. All right, Larry, we're going to spend a lot of time talking about that side of your life and what you're doing now. We'll spend time talking about that military career, but let's go back to the beginning. Where did you initially become introduced to horses, and when did you first fall in love with the sport?
Well, I moved to Timonium when I was 10, and my family did, to avail themselves of the great school system out in Timonium for my sister who needed some special education. And we were about a mile away from the Maryland State Fairgrounds, and my dad would take me to Timonium back when they had a 42-day meet, and he would bet show bets for me. And like anybody who's in this business, I must have won my first few bets or I wouldn't have stuck it out. But I remember back then my parents would say, if you need to know something, go to the encyclopedia. So I went to the encyclopedia and looked up thoroughbred racehorse, and it described that one of the attributes it listed was a deep chest. And I asked my mother what a deep chest was, and she said, oh, it's just a big, big, broad, voluminous chest. So I would go out the next day and pick the horse with the biggest chest in the paddock and ask my dad to bet the show on it. But I would be using my allowance money, so I'd bet $1 to show or $1.50. And he was excited to show me that you're going to lose in this game if you keep doing it, but he ended up paying out, I think, more than I gave him. So that was just so much fun and just very addictive for me to have, here's this puzzle with all these different data that you have to analyze, and what some matters and some doesn't. And it just was an engrossing challenge for me to figure out. And then to be around sports is just something that's always excited me. I just love the competition. I love waking up and it's game day if it's football, or it's race day if it's a horse race. I think there's no better excitement than the anticipation of the big event.
Do you remember the first really good, we'll call it the first good ticket that you cashed when you were growing up and betting the horses?
Absolutely. It was $42.80 I remember the first bet I ever cashed was Foolish William to show, paid 360. And then the first good hit was 4280 in an exacta, and I was just betting Barry Sasser and maybe Rudy Turcotte. You know, they were riding Timonium back then. And anyway, to hit an exacta, I'll never forget that $42.80 payoff. And I'll never forget, my mother looked in the Maryland Horse Directory and found that Bruce Fenwick was not that far away from us in Timonium. So as a 12-year-old going on 13, she got me a summer job working at Bruce's beautiful farm, Belmont Farm, right on the Maryland, right on the outskirts of the Maryland Hunt Cup course. And Bruce taught me how to drive a tractor and how to muck a stall and how to throw hay and paid me $1.50 an hour. And I remember the first check I got for $84, and I said, I'll never spend all this. So, and then he said, if you stay with me on the weekends in the winter, he liked what I was doing, I'll give you $2.50 an hour. And I was like, oh, man, I'm in. So.
Wow. Well, yeah. It's a great story. All of us have that story about remembering that first bet that we cashed, that bet that really got us hooked on playing this game. How about the first horse, Larry, that you started to kind of really become attached to and fall in love with?
Well, the very first one would have been a junior horse that I got. I rode in one race at the Old Dominion point-to-point in Benvenue, Virginia, as a 16-year-old. And I was still bony enough to make – it was catch weights for just junior riders. And I had so much fun training Turn to Silver before school. That was the name of the horse, Turn to Silver. And then I rode him in a race, and it scared me sufficiently enough when I got bumped by a Woods Winans going around a turn that I said, I think I'm going to stick to football. It's a lot safer. So there was that experience, which was just great. And that's what, as a 15-year-old, a cold morning as the sun came up and I was breezing Turn to Silver up the hills in Green Spring Valley, and suddenly the horse stopped because a doe and a fawn were near me, and then the doe and the fawn and the horse suddenly stopped and looked ahead because a big red fox trotted in front of us. And this was happening at dawn in Green Spring Valley. And that was the moment when I said, I think people do this for a living. I want to investigate this. And from time I was a 10th grader, I wanted to go to Cornell and learn animal science. And so I did that. And the best horse I ever had as a trainer was Big Big Affair. That's an amazing story if you want me to tell that now.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, go ahead.
So this is an amazing story. So I had a great owner named Mike Kirchenbauer, who's an FBI agent, and he had partners. And they had a two-punch filly named What a Knockout, who was kind of crazy and would flip in the paddock and hurt herself and hurt people. And he got wind of me that I turned my horses out a lot, and he said, can you take her on? So I took her on, and she was a two-punch speed horse, and we ran her regularly at Charlestown and had some wins and started making money with her, and she got her calmed down. And the Charlestown people finally got tired of her hitting the board every week or whatever, and they claimed her for $7,500. And it was a homebred of Mike's. And he came to me and said, Larry, if I disperse this $7,500 to everybody, this partnership's over, and because we're about $80,000 down. He said, is there anybody we could claim tomorrow or the next day so I don't have to write these people a check? And I said, well, it's funny you ask, because Billy Christmas had a horse, a homebred of his called Big Big Affair that I wanted to buy, but he said he wanted to run it one more time for $6,500, that I'd be happy to claim it if I wanted to. And I said, he's in tomorrow. And then we tried to get the money, and Charleston said, we can't write you a check right away. So I called up Scott Posey. I said, I see your horse, David Bloom, won a race on Wednesday. Could we borrow some money on the first race Sunday at Laurel out of his account to claim this horse? And we claimed Big Big Affair for $6,500. And over the next 3 years, we went on to win $226,000 with her.
Wow.
Because she ended up being able to go long on the turf, as in a mile and three-eighths, a mile and a half, mile and a quarter. And I won races with her, with Mike Smith on her, with Craig Perret on her, Craig Perret, and Herb McCauley would ride her, even had Jacinto Vasquez on her. It was just a whirlwind bit of fun. And before they had the Weather Channel, I played or maybe right as the Weather Channel was created, I heard that Hurricane Danielle was going up the coast, and I stuck her in a grade two, the Noble Damsel Stakes at Belmont, knowing that she liked the mud. And it scratched. She was 30-1 morning line, but it scratched from 12 down to 4, and only the front three were really trying. The other one was just galloping around. We beat one and got her graded stakes placed because I was, you know, that's where you learn as a trainer. The Weather Channel is your best friend. So that was exciting to be with her year in, year out, and she could run on any surface, any distance, and she was a. And the best part is when we'd ship to Saratoga, she'd go in the stall and take a nap. So those are the kind you really just can't help but admire incredibly.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Do you ever see yourself going back to training horses full time again?
Perhaps. Yeah, I enjoy the there's a lot of waiting involved in horse racing, where you're waiting for a race to come, or waiting for a horse to grow up, or waiting for the shins to fill in. And I really find that this other regular job I have is a wonderful way of staying active. And then again, I mean, I guess the short answer is sure. Yes, I do. But I also enjoy just being sort of a manager, a stable manager. And I've had trainers. I'm thinking of sending two horses to Helen Pitts in Turfway Park in Kentucky. You know, I use Chuck Lawrence. Julie Papata helped me out at Finger Lakes Presque Isle Downs when I kept some horses there. And so I'm really excited about using – you look at Mark Cassie and Pletcher, and the really good stables have a whole lot of options. They have a lot of different divisions, and I want to be that way, where I think that it's not somebody's fault that they're training in a location where that horse would do better in another location. So I see myself as a stable manager who again, I like to kind of train a little bit, but not full time, and I think I'm in a position where I don't have to hold people's hands and explain to them why their horse lost and help them grieve over their loss, and that's a great thing to not have to do, because that's a huge role that trainers have, which is to process defeat, because as my friend Joe Davies once said, horse racing is the only game where 8 out of 10 people are disappointed with how it turned out.
So true.
Every time.
So true. Talking with trainer Larry Smith here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Larry, you said at the age of 10 that you knew at that point you really wanted to get into animal science and go to Cornell to do that. When did you decide that you wanted to pursue a career in the military?
So yeah, it was 10th grade. It was the age of 15.
All right.
Yeah, that I had that epiphany that this is what I want to do. I've always been involved with sports and motivation and leadership and accomplishing the impossible. And so the military was just a natural extension of all the varsity sports that I'd played, whether it's baseball or football or basketball. And so I always looked at the Army as my after-school sport as an adult. And then when all the wars broke out in 2003, 2004, and my son had been born in 2003, I knew that I would be called up because I had a lot to offer the military as a major. And so I requested orders at the Pentagon where I could take the MARC train every day and still see some horses, have a little bit of the horses for phase them out a bit. And that was an amazing sort of beam me up, Scotty, where I went from working on a farm to being in the National Military Command Center as an intelligence officer, where we'd support the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff with the daily requirements that he needed to brief the Secretary of Defense. So it was a terrific experience going through the Iraq War at the Pentagon, and then staying on with J2 and DIA, and then volunteering to go to Afghanistan in 2010, where 6.5 months at Bagram Airfield as the operations officer there, where I would in-process the different intelligence agents that would be coming through and get them a weapon that was zeroed to their ability to fire it and pull off the intelligence apparatus that we needed in Bagram, including the I was the head of the combat taxi service where my guys would go pick up people at the Kabul airport and deliver them where they needed to be. And,
oh, wow.
And that was pretty amazing stuff. So I always thought that horse racing was sort of a form of entertainment and maybe not something that, you know, something like national security would come ahead of it. So I was always willing to do that if they needed me.
Yeah, it kind of puts it all in perspective for sure. When you were overseas and you were deployed, were you able to keep up with horse racing, or did you try to at that point?
At that point, when you're overseas, and this is before ExpressBet and all the good technology and then not much internet bandwidth anyway, I would say no. I'd say I just kind of let it go.
Yeah.
And so when I started back in the game, I had to relearn all the stallions and where we were. but it definitely, J.B. Secord told me, because you're like a fresh horse coming off a layoff, because you take 10 years off, and he's right. Every day I'm thrilled to be back in horse racing, and my wife and I are also involved in buying horses and selling at the sales, and we developed a system that's based on what I learned at Cornell and how attributes are spread across populations and also in statistics, where we take the true NICs ratings of more than just the standard NIC, but we know there's four NICs going on with the mother and father of the sire mixing with the mother and father of the dam. So I figured out a system based on what I learned along the way that gives a numerical rating that weights all those crosses, we've hit a couple home runs. We purchased Slew Good to Be True, which is trained by Peter Yurton as a weanling for $1,200, and she was by Jimmy Creed, who had as yet not had any racehorses to race, and we sold her 18 months later for $110,000.
So wow,
that was pretty amazing. And then recently we just bought a Uncle Lino filly out of Harlan's Holiday Mare for $5,200 and sold her 10 months later for $40,000. So we think there's something to the numerical numbers. And the cool thing about Slew Good to Be True is it was the Fazzik Tipton December mix sale, and she by far had the highest number of anything that I'd looked at. And yet we only paid $1,200 for.
Yeah, and that number, obviously, when people are listening, we talk about nicking and all that kind of stuff, which is a common term in the industry. That number based solely on pedigree, because obviously they're young horses. They haven't even gotten to the races yet. So it's solely on the pedigree and the breeding of that horse, correct?
It's completely the pedigree, and it's what Steve Bick called a harmonic pedigree, where the broodmare sires and the grandparents are mixing well. Not only the main nick, not only the father and the mother, but the other. It reminds me of when you see a tall child with two short parents, you realize the grandparents haven't gone away. And so that's what our system quantifies and rates. And it's exciting because I think the pedigree actually gets discounted as they get into the 2-year-old in training sale. All I hear on horse racing radio shows is that people are looking for the physical look, but you know, there's still so much that you can't see when they breeze a 1/8 of a mile, or they're just 2, and what will they look like when they're 5? And so I think it's so critical to continue to look deep into the pedigree, well into their 2-year-old year, and even, you know, if you're going to buy a horse that's unraced, it's more than just when you breed them or buy them as a yearling or a weanling. It tells a lot about what their potential chance of success is.
Yeah, back to the name.
Because I'll just say there's a lot of good-looking horses in $5,000 claimers that are really good-looking horses, and they're going to be nice show horses, but they weren't especially good race horses. So,
yeah. Larry Smith here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fazzik Tipton. We're going to get to a short break. When we come back, we'll double back on that story he just told you about the Jimmy Creed filly, Slew Good to Be True, because the name has an interesting history to it as well. I'll tell you all about that, and we'll tell you about some of his philosophies on training horses now. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fazzik Tipton. Stay with us.
one book, one session, one spectacular evening. On November 5th, the stars will align at Fasig Tipton, featuring a catalog of top race fillies, world-class broodmares, and selected weanlings. A night of stars with over 60 graded stakes winners or producers and no less than 24 Grade 1 winners, champions, or producers. No Sale offers a higher concentration of quality anywhere in the world. The world's premier breeding stock event, the November Sale, November 5th in Lexington, Kentucky. Where will you be?
Bloom Racing. Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Pulling away from Come Dancing, Mopetism, and the others, Midnight Bizou leaves no doubt today. She won the FIPS in hand.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now. Get in on the action at bloomracing.com.
Talking with Dr. Jim Chiappetta of Flair Equine Nasal Strips. Jim, do the strips help with EIPH?
Essentially, all horses that work hard are vulnerable to EIPH. As with any elite athlete, we are pushing performance horses to their physiological limits. And when we do, things can break. In this case, blood vessels in the lungs. Nothing stops EIPH. Only two things have been clinically proven to reduce EIPH: Flair strips and Lasix. Alone or with Lasix, Flair strips protect horses from EIPH.
Learn more at flairstrips.com/learn.
This is Trainer Talk on HRRN, presented by Fasig Tipton.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on HRRN. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, coming to you once again from our Jimmy John's of Lexington broadcast studios. Happy to have you back with me for the second half of the program, continuing my visit with trainer Larry Smith, who is based in Maryland, as you heard us mention in the first half of the program. And for those of you who may be just joining us, Larry served our country for roughly three decades. He served in Korea. He served in Afghanistan. He worked at the Pentagon after 9/11, retired as a lieutenant colonel, and now working alongside his wife at their farm in Westminster, Maryland, to train horses and breed horses and even own some, and doing a tremendous job now, and going to continue with this visit momentarily right after I do remind you that if you missed any portion of the show, head back over to our website. That's horseracingradio.net. You can check out a podcast of this show, all of our shows, at your leisure, horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. And one other quick reminder, you'll want to head over to our website to check out our entire Breeders' Cup Week programming schedule. It all begins next Tuesday, live from Santa Anita Park in Arcadia, California. We'll be there with the first of three Breeders' Cup Countdown morning shows starting next Tuesday morning, 8 to 10 Pacific, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And again, all that information, the SiriusXM information, the streaming information, the entire schedule posted right now on our website. More than 25 hours of Breeders' Cup Week programming right here on HRRN. So make us your home for every Breeders' Cup race that Friday and Saturday as well. Horseracingradio.net. All right, Larry, let's double back here for a second. When we were getting to the end of the first half of the program, you were telling me the story of some of the horses that you've made nice scores with on the pinhooking side of things, and that Jimmy Creed filly by the name of Slew Good to Be True, who you purchased for $1,200, sold for $110,000 as a two-year-old in training, that qualifies as a big score in anybody's book. The name, Slew Good to Be True, has an interesting backstory to it as well.
Well, sure. So Connie, my wife, it was instrumental in helping me look at the horses at the sales, and her daughter Megan, and Slew Good was not named when we bought her. It was a leap of faith to get her. And then we were looking for, I looked at recently retired names that had been released, recently released names in the Jockey Club register, and Slew Good to Be True was there, and she had once said after we dated three or four times that she let it come out with her outside voice, and she goes, "I think you're too good to be true." So when we saw Slew Good to Be True, we said, "I guess that's our name." So the best part was that about 3 days after the sale, we actually got married. It was already, scheduled, whatever. But they ended up being right next to each other. It was quite a week. We sold her and then got married. And then the next day we drove to Belmont Park and watched Starry Messenger run third in a New York Bred Allowance race. So it was a, for horse people, it was a storybook.
Yeah. How about the after party, the reception? Did that go to another level after selling a horse like that?
Well, that was great, and that was one of the few. I did as many wardrobe changes as Madonna because my band played my own wedding for about 13 songs.
No way.
Connie insisted on it, so that was a lot of fun. We had it at our farm in Westminster, so. So it's just I'm really blessed to have a partner who's as interested in the details as I am. She wants to know what the acronym stands for. And I remember when she says, you got to stop calling these people bugs. When I was talking about some jockeys, she goes, that's really not polite. Then I had explained to her what it meant, you know.
You know what's funny? The terminology of this sport is so unique. And I've talked about that a lot on other programs, and I have over the years, that when you bring new people to the racetrack, Larry, there's a good chance that they're going to be, number one, very intimidated, and number two, they're not going to have a clue what's going on, not because it's horse racing, but because of a lot of the terminology that's thrown around that isn't necessarily mainstream terminology.
Not at all. And then I also love the fact that we hijack the English grammar, and we never say a horse won last week. They say he win last week, and he yeah. went six last year. I had him for a year, and he win three races. It's not that he won three; he win three. And if you don't say it that way, you're not a real. They can tell you're not in the horse world.
They didn't use that terminology at Cornell.
Well, Cornell is right about dairy cows, and so I had to, the only guy who could read the racing form was my barber. But I am proud to say that Chad Brown's the other Cornell educated trainer
yeah.
out there, and he and I have connected a few times at Saratoga and talked about our times at Cornell.
That's great. So, that's great.
It's not bad company, I think.
No, I would say you're in good company there with Chad. Let's talk about your philosophy when it comes to training horses. When I met you last week at the Maryland Million, you were telling me that you have an interesting approach when you get horses to the races. Tell me about that.
Sure. So, like any trainer, when I was doing it full time in the 90s and early zero aughts or whatever, I was beset with a regular diet of removing this chip or that chip or this soft tissue injury or this quarter crack. And it was so frustrating because I was like, I can always find a cheaper race, but once they're hurt, you're do not pass go, do not collect $200. And I was driving some horse to Suffolk Downs or some really long ship that I'm usually game to try and go wherever the race is that fits the horse. And it occurred to me that their feet are in front of them. They're not underneath of them. So that if their feet are in front of their legs, then it's a leverage problem. It's a torque on the ankle that the farther the foot is out in front of the farther the distance between the ground and the fetlock, the more torque there is on that lever every time the ankle drops down, because the force is constant. It's whatever they weigh times however fast they're going. But it's much easier to carry your groceries if they're next to your body than if they're 2 feet, if you hold your arm out and try to carry your groceries that way.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, you don't play basketball in running shoes because the distance between the ground and those fat running shoes is too dangerous if you don't land well. And women are nervous to wear high heels because they'll twist their ankles. And yet, we add shoes to their feet to extend the distance between the ankle and the ground. And again, another thing is you never buy a horse at a sale with a long pastern because it makes them susceptible to injury, to tendons and suspensories. And all the bone, all the chips happen on the front of the joints where the ankle drops down and the lower and upper bones smash into each other and they chip the ankle and the knee, same way with the knee. So it was a sudden eureka moment, like, oh, my gosh, if we can just keep the ankle from dropping down so far, I'll have fewer injuries. And then it is also a reminder that shoes were only introduced as a wearing surface, so that when Alexander the Great invaded Persia with his horses and they walked 20 miles a day, their feet wore down on the dry soil of the Eastern world. And so he invented shoes to give them a wearing surface. But there's nothing particularly athletically beneficial about a straight piece of iron or aluminum. There's nothing that it just transmits all the force anyway. But it also robs the horse of their natural shock absorption system, which is the hoof. And so the hoof, with exercise, grows into this fat, supple structure with a big frog with lots of tubules inside the frog that absorb shock as they pump blood through those little tubules in the same way that a hydrostatic shock works in a truck or something. And then we add shoes for protection, I guess, and then it robs the foot of what it was supposed to do, and then we add distance. And if you think about it, aluminum shoes are relatively new inventions, and they're about twice the width of steel shoes because aluminum is so much weaker than steel. But Man of War did not run in aluminum shoes. He ran in thin little steel shoes. And if you go to the Museum of Horse Racing and look at the shoes that Lexington wore that are up on the wall, they're tiny little pieces of steel that are barely the size of the nail, enough for the nail to get in. So long story short is I just experimented, and it was kind of scary. I went barefoot for a while, then they would slip behind because they don't have a lot of weight behind. They're like a pickup truck in the snow without much weight, but they got a lot of weight up front with their neck and the jockey and their head. And so I ended up with just back shoes, and it's amazing. It's just amazing. It's like unlocking the cracking the code for keeping horses sound. Mm-hmm. I mean, both Starry Messenger and Second Encore are in their 20s. They've run about 20, 21 times this year, both each, so 42 starts apiece. And their best races have been in the last few months. I mean, they're getting better as the year goes on, and that's the way it should be. And so I'm thrilled that it's not easy. It sometimes takes 3 or 4 months for a good athletic foot to grow out. So you can't claim a horse and pull the shoes and start running them barefoot. But if the best is to let a baby never have front shoes and just run them that way, it's something that's working extremely well for me, and it keeps the horses happy, and I don't have any pulled shoes, I don't have any quarter cracks. It's just an incredible discovery that I came upon.
Yeah, when did you first start running horses like that?
Around 2000, I guess.
Okay.
And I went through all the way, you know, I'd go through a little slump, and I'd put all the shoes back on, and it wouldn't do any better. Or the horse that had ankles, the ankles would come back with the shoes back on. So I've done all the testing and ended up with, you know, traction behind and let them slide and come over their foot naturally up front. The other funny thing is that you come to find that they don't break over in the middle of their foot. They break over at 1 o'clock on their right foot and then at 11 o'clock on their left foot. They're slightly to the outside of the middle. And again, the frogs grow big, the heels get engaged. If you think about it, when you have a lame horse, the first thing you do is put a bar shoe on to re-engage the frog. And so you get that with bare feet. And the other thing, the horse that's been shod 5 years, let's say, continuously, will get these long toes and sort of contracted heels, which is called long toe, low heel syndrome. And that's reversed immediately with bare feet. And I give a lot of biotin to my horses. It helps them establish those feet. But man, once they get what I call American Indian feet, where the American Indians would run through the woods barefooted, that's what my horses can do, and it's just exciting to see them so sound, and it's definitely made a difference.
Yeah, interesting philosophy. He's trainer Larry Smith here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Along those same lines, Larry, unfortunately, one of the topics that has really dominated the headlines in thoroughbred racing this year is all of the injuries and catastrophic injuries that horses have suffered at various racetracks across the country. You co-authored a letter that was published on the Pollock Report in July, and it was titled "In Defense of Horse Racing, Facing the Question of Ethics." And I've often said on this program and others that as a sport, we do not do a good job. We do a horrific job of defending ourselves and showing people all of the good things and the caring that goes into this game. And you pointed all of those out in that particular article.
Well, thanks for bringing that up, Mike, because I knew that somebody with my background and my formal education, and I called upon my lawyer friend, Alec Wallen, who's a PhD in ethics in law. He's a lawyer with a PhD in ethics. specifically, and I called upon him to help me construct this argument. And it basically comes down to the fact that we all operate under the philosophy that the healthier and the happier my horses are, the more money they'll make me. And the overarching engine behind that philosophy is the horse racing industry itself, that it provides the incentive to treat your horses as well as you can possibly think of. That every trainer lays awake at night thinking, what kind of toy can I give this horse? Maybe I can give him a goat. Maybe I can cut a hole in the wall. Maybe I can turn him out. Maybe I can train him the other way. Whatever it is, we're trying to make them as happy and as healthy as possible. And every time they run, our number one fear is to protect the investment. We don't care that much how we run that day. We don't want the horse to get a catastrophic or career-ending injury. So there's incredible incentives from the day they're born that they're treated and protected from predators, and they're protected from parasites, and they're protected from flies, and all the things that they wouldn't get in nature, we provide them. And we give them this incredible fun that's a primal joy of every species, which is to race and to run as fast as you can. You look at any species, the cubs love to race each other. And so they love racing them. And we only breed the horses that are good at it and love it, and then, by golly, their kids love it too. And the number one thing a trainer does is to get them to slow down. Not yet, not yet, not yet, not yet. I know you want to go fast. Not yet.
Yeah.
And so Alec and I helped explain this, and I'm really excited because there's a podcast called What Really Happened by Andrew Jenks. It's his executive producer is Dwayne The Rock Johnson. It's going to come out in the next few weeks. It's on jenkspod.com, and it's the number one podcast on Apple Radio, Apple products. And it's on those 30 fatalities at Santa Anita, and Alec and I are the defenders of the sport. And I'm really excited. We did a telephone interview similar to what I'm doing with you, and I commend everybody to make sure they catch that, and I'll let you know when that comes out, Mike, so you can spread the word and people can listen to that podcast, because Andrew Jenks gives it a real fair hearing of what really happened at Santa Anita.
Yeah, no, and I think, you know, the things you point out in that particular piece that was submitted to the Pollock Report are all of the things that I've been saying need to be out there. You know, all of the different veterinary and dental care and the love that's shown to these horses. You know, you go back to the nursing from their well-fed and cared-for mothers and sleeping securely in sunny fields. And if people get a chance to walk around some of the horse farms, not just here in Kentucky, but in other parts of the country, they'll see that first and foremost, it's about the love of the horse. And that's a message that needs to be out there. And as a sport, as an industry, I think we fail miserably at getting that message out there. So
we really do, and that's why I wanted to give sort of a talking point or a structure for people to argue back. This just happened last week. I was driving to Belmont, and a woman made me roll down my window. She said, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm going to Belmont Park." She goes, "Oh," and she was really downside that I. She says, "You're exploiting that horse." I was like, "No, I'm not." I said, "He can't. He loves it. He's really excited." She goes, "But he's back there shaking his head." I said, "Well, he's upset that we're not there yet." "Well, so am I." I said, "We're stuck in this traffic. He wants to get to Belmont so he can go have some fun." And that's what people. And we just need to educate people. They're right to be concerned, and there are certain things that we can do better. You know, there is always going to be the threat of cheaters in this game because there's money to be had. And we need a commissioner that controls the behavior of racetracks when it comes to their PR and what they do with horses that have to be euthanized, et cetera, et cetera. So we need an NFL commissioner that can keep everybody acting in the best interest of horse racing in the same way that NFL commissioner keeps every person acting in the best interest of the NFL.
Yeah, in an ideal world, that would certainly be the solution. Yeah, it's a message that definitely needs to get out there. There's no doubt about it. Let's turn back to your horses here for a minute, Larry, and tell me the couple of horses that, when you think back on the ones that you've had the privilege to be around, that for whatever reason you think, okay, this is a horse that I'm going to remember as long as I live.
Well, thanks. Yeah, it makes me think of a horse called Two Bows that I got that was bred by Allaire DuPont and had gotten a bone injury or something as a baby. It's a baby thing, and it was just an average horse. And that's just what I say, throw in right here, that the reason, the main reason a lot of trainers are high-percentage trainers or high-percentage jockeys is that they're able to pick and choose the horses that they train. So a Pletcher or something can turn away a horse that's an average horse, and the best jockeys turn away a lot of the mounts they're offered because they don't see them as a high-probability chance of winning. And so this horse was given to my owner, and we trained her, and she was just, she's by 2 points, had a little bit of speed. But as you go through conditions, number one, two, number one, three, you're suddenly not fast enough to get to the number one, four. And so I'm getting out running 5/8 on the turf, and she's running barefooted. And I think to myself, I got to make her go long. But if she goes long, she'll go to the lead and she'll stop. I got to figure out a way that she can come from behind and use her speed at the end. If I can, you know, if I took the blinkers off and we're trying to get her relaxed, and she'll gallop all day, but if you let her go full speed, she'll stop. So I run her 10 National on August 4th, 2005, or something like that. And I tell her, rider, we're 44-1 or something. I say, look, this is just an experiment. I want you, when you go into the first turn, I want you to keep going straight. And when they turn left, I want you to tuck in behind somebody and get her covered up. And then I want you to stay covered up until you can't take it anymore and swing her out. I just want to see if she'll pass horses up the lane. And so she stayed. It worked perfectly. He let them all make the left turn. He covered up. And then turning for home, she swung to the 7 path. And I said, oh, cool, she's passing. Oh, cool, I'm going to get a check. Oh, my God, I just won. And she won by a nose and paid $90 and got her number 1-4 for 10 claiming. And then it was near the end of the year, and I was like, well, Suffolk Downs has, and that was going a mile, Suffolk Downs has a race on Wednesday going 7.5, and other than first allowance conditions. So I entered her the next day at Suffolk Downs, and we drove to Suffolk Downs and ran 4 days later. And I said, well, this will work. And a lot of times when you run right back, they're a little bit sharper. But so the cutback, as you'd call it, from a mile to 7.5 was fine with me. And Larry Colm was called the race up at Suffolk, and she won that race by a head. So she won it. Her never won four in her allowance 4 days apart. And that was just, to me, it was just there was an opportunity where the trainer made a difference, where I said, let me try to change up her running style and take advantage of a B-League allowance race. And then it just makes you feel good when you can attack it from a different way, and it works.
Yeah, what do they say? You love it when a plan comes together, right?
And particularly out of the box plan. Yeah,
yeah, no doubt about it. Let me throw another name at you, Larry. Royal Matrimony. When I say that name, what comes to mind?
Well, that was my first filly ever, and first horse I ever trained. Bought her as a 2-year-old for an owner that I was able to talk about partnering with me. And anyway, it was just great to, as a baby, she was showing some speed and not stopping. I mean, she was showing some ability, but not quick enough. So I remember as a young trainer entering her at the Meadowlands and driving up there and running her against a favorite of Dickie Small's. And she went wire to wire with Steve Johnson, who's the famous race caller down the stretch they come?
Oh, Dave Johnson.
Dave Johnson was calling the race, and she anyway, that was my first win as a trainer, and my mother was there and everything, and the van ride home was just was basically the definition of cloud nine, you know, where you win a maiden special weight with a horse and up at the Meadowlands under the lights, and it was just it's what gets you through the rough spots, and you just sit back and think of a little bit of that, and you're like, oh, we'll get there again. You know?
Do you still have the wind picture somewhere at your house?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Of course, on a special place,
trainer's,
I'm sure.
First win. Yeah.
Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah.
How about you? We have about 4 minutes left, I guess. We're getting ready to wrap up the show, but was your mom interested in horse racing, or did she just follow it because of you?
Well, that's a great question. I'm really proud of my mother. She was she met my father in grad school at the University of Chicago. So you can see I came from a lot of education in my family. And she was a political science major, has a master's degree in political science. And she worked as a woman in the early 60s in the operations center of the State Department. So I didn't even put two and two together. Here I was at the Pentagon and my mother had done almost the same thing 40 years earlier as a woman. And it's just unbelievable. And then the cool thing was she grew up in Lexington. She went to the University of Kentucky when Bear Bryant was their football coach. And so she loved horses, and she was instrumental in driving me anywhere I needed to go as a kid, to go out to Bruce Fenwick's, to go to Tom Voss's where I worked afterwards, and to be with Tom Voss, that whole experience. Anyway, so my mother was lives on with me as my greatest fan.
You have a son, Nathan, who is now a teenager. Does he have any interest in horse racing at all?
Well, the interest he shares with me is he's incredibly competitive. And when he loses, he'll sometimes cry the way Tom Brady will. And I'll say, never lose that. Because look how far it got Tom Brady. You know, and they that's the same compliment they gave to Michael Jordan and what they just recently gave to Lamar Jackson, is that the most important thing is to be incredibly competitive, and then the rest is to set the bar higher than even your coach sets it. And yeah, so for that reason, my son loves the horse racing part of it, but he's a better basketball player than I ever was, and he's a very good baseball player. And so I'm excited to help him get to wherever his roads take him. But he and I love nothing more than watching a Sports Center together and talking about the game of life.
Yeah, you know, I got to tell you, Larry, you were doing so good. You spent the full hour with me, and then all of a sudden you managed to work in the New England Patriots quarterback and the Baltimore Ravens quarterback in one sentence.
Here they come.
Yeah, I didn't know how you did that, but I guess it's about time to wrap this up now, which is good, because we started to go down that road. So,
well, they play each other November 3rd. It's going to be great.
Yeah, it should be a lot of fun. Larry Smith here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Before I let you go, I know you're a big sports guy, so is it all about football, or are there other sports that you will follow?
I would say if I had to say who my favorite team is, it's the Washington Wizards.
Okay.
I love the excitement and the teamwork and the basketball. I coached basketball, youth basketball with my son, and so I love going to a Wizards game. And we're going to go see the L.A. Clippers on December 7th.
Good for you. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. Thank you, Mike.
Larry, I can't thank you enough for the visit. Been a lot of fun. All of our guests who appear on the program receive a gift courtesy of one of our sponsors. It is Flair Equine Nasal Strip. So we'll send those out to you. And, again, thanks so much for your service to our country. Thank you for spending the time with me here tonight. And all the best moving forward as well. Go get it done.
The pleasure is mine. You do a great job, Mike. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Larry. That's trainer Larry Smith here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. If you want to find him in the program, you can look for Lawrence M. Smith. That's how he runs his horses. And great visit. There was so much more we could have talked about, but ran out of time. And again, for those individuals like Larry who are out there and serving our country, whether it be abroad or here in the United States, thank you for your service. Don't forget, if you missed any portion, head over to horseracingradio.net. Check out the podcast at your leisure. You can also do that, Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. Follow us on social media at HRN and check out the website, horseracingradio.net, for a complete Breeders' Cup Week broadcast schedule. For our producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Mike Pena. Thanks for listening to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton.